No, my back isn't hurting. But I am going to change up a little bit. I announced that I would be doing my first sermon, and I remembered that sermon and every moment of it and the reaction and what it felt like to go out to a Unitarian Universalist congregation, the second service I ever attended in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. I was the student minister, and I was doing the sermon. And I had a great deal of confidence because I enjoyed public speaking and had a lot of experience and working in coffee houses, which were the kind of mini nightclubs of the day. And I felt really good because the first Unitarian service I ever attended, other than my own wedding, the first actual formal on Sunday service, the minister preached a sermon on the topic of my master's thesis. And so, man, I knew everything. I was cool. And that was such and I remembered that sermon that I gave, and it was wonderful. And I dug it out of my files, and I found it. It was a really nice talk for a cultural anthropology course at a university. It was not a sermon. It was, and I'm afraid it segues and begins, and I'll end the talk on this, with how women have been abused by religion. The name of the sermon was The Role of Women in Religious Myth, and it was pretty good cultural anthropology, not sermon. But there were two wonderful moments as I reread it, and one of them was the opening, which was women have been objectified and persecuted by religion ever since the first Pithecanthropus erectus stumbled out of his cave having tripped on his own name. Got a bigger laugh in 1969. I think people were just generally impressed that I could say it. And the second nice image was that the first thing that men did was put a woman on a pedestal, then put the pedestal in the home, then lock the gates. And that really is, with 3,000 words of sermon, that was what it was. That was the core of it. And it remains memorable to me as my introduction and my first sermon that wasn't a sermon. But I think back on other kinds of firsts as I'm going to wander down memory lane with you today, and I will actually end with something that is quasi-sermonic. And that was one of my favorite moments was being completely lost and not having a clue what to do. You have to understand that whether at teacher's college or med school or law school, when you first get out of school, you're filled with a lot of information, but not necessarily anything that's of immediate use. And the situations that you walk into are often surprising, and you want to be able to make a phone call and get help. So having come out of a Unitarian, a Universalist seminary, Star King School for Liberal Religion and Ministry, I'm sitting in my office at Star King Church of Hayward, and somebody made an appointment for counseling and came in and sat down, and I said, so what is your presenting issue? I talked shrink talk back then because I had been trained in shrink talk in Vienna and at Napa State Hospital. So I go from the shrink mode to the comedy mode to the minister mode because I was just putting on costumes and hadn't really integrated any of this. So I'm ready for anything. And she said, well, John, I can't get Christ in my heart. There's nothing in Unitarian Universalist religious training that prepares you for that to be the presenting issue. So at the time, thank God, I smoked a pipe. So I sat down, I took my pipe, we could then smoke in public back then, and I filled it, I tamped it, I lit it, I tamped it, I relit it. And then channeling, you know, if you don't know how to be a minister, you had really two choices, and that was You had one. It was really Barry Fitzgerald. So I said, well, you know, that's a problem. I can understand, you know. What are we going to do about that? I hadn't a clue. So I asked, well, what do you mean? And she said, I'm scared and I'm lonely. And my Christian friends tell me if I will only get Christ in my heart, I won't be frightened and lonely anymore. What a terrible thing to say to an otherwise shallow and glib person. Because the question is this a teachable moment? Am I going to go into advanced Christology and talk about what is the reality and what do we mean by Christ? And is this really the question was a statement, I'm lonely and I'm frightened. And from that moment to this moment at our joys and sorrows, that is part of the human condition. And it was a great learning experience for me because I didn't have a glib answer or an easy answer. All I had then, as all I have now, as all we have now, is to be present to one another, to be company on the trip, to let service be our prayer and not believe that we have to have an answer to every problem that comes to us. Sometimes it's a shrug, sometimes it's a tear, sometimes it's a hug. And that was important because it began for me a process of taking people seriously instead of the images that they use seriously. Not fighting about the Christ word, not fighting about denominationalism and theology, but talking about what we can do for each other as we go through life's journey and how we can keep each other good company without having to have an answer. So many times people stay away from hurting people because they don't have an answer. We witness our values with how we live, not with the words, the explanations, the philosophy, even the creeds. We live our religion. Our religion is not about belief. It is about how we attempt to live together. And it's always made me, or ever since that moment, has helped me understand that our fundamental job is human and it's contact and it's being good company. I remember my first wedding, and I didn't know that I had the power to perform this kind of magical thing. And my first wedding was Larry Toy, Dr. Larry Toy, who was an astronomer PhD candidate at the time, and he later became head of Cal State University for all of California. And I remember that wedding so well because he wrote his own ceremony, and I used much of it. And as an astronomer, his first lines were, I thought, beautiful. He said, in a universe whose size is beyond human imagining, where our world floats like a dust mote in the void of night, we have grown inconceivably lonely. We scan the universe for signs and portents. We search the stars. There is a path, but it appears to wander. It is out of this infinity of the universe that you two have met and joined in a common bond that we are here to celebrate. What a wonderful gift for a young person at the beginning of ministry to have Larry Toy write those words from his heart and from astronomy. Of course, the other outstanding thing was that he and his fiancée were from Hong Kong, and the reception was incredible. It was really wonderful. And they're under warranty. I hope to contact them to do a re-up as they approach 50th, their 50th year. Not every wedding is as beautiful as that. I have done two weddings that did not survive the reception. So any of those you who are not yet married and are thinking about it, you might take that into consideration. The first one was a home wedding, and he had three kids from a previous. She had three kids from a previous, and they didn't follow my instructions. And so at the home wedding, a baby starts crying, the phone rings, and a basset hound comes in and decides that the bride is more attractive than he should have really thought. And it's the only time that I've ever lost my professional cool and giggled. It wasn't this that broke up the marriage. It was at the end of the ceremony, in the middle of the reception, he said, "Oh, by the way, honey, I signed a teaching contract for 2 years in the Marshall Islands. Take good care of the kids. I'll see you in the summer." No amount of premarital counseling can really uncover fraud. And so she suggested several, let's say, anatomically difficult things he could do on his way to the Marshall Islands, and then asked if I could tear up the certificate, which I couldn't, because as an agent of the state, it's like a notary. But I said, "I think you have grounds for annulment." And in fact, they did. The other one that didn't survive the reception was at the Bel Air Hotel. This was way before we were boycotting at the Sultan of Brunei. But at the Bel Air Hotel, and he was 56 years old and had never been married before. And she was in her mid-late 30s and had a teenage daughter. And I get to the ceremony, and the 56-year-old groom's mother is going like this, which I thought was probably a bad sign and helped explain why he hadn't been married before. And she's keening and tearing and grieving and rending flesh. So after the ceremony, after the kiss, we're at the reception. They walk in and announce that it's over. Not the reception, the marriage. Because he had said, "Well, we're going to pick up your stuff and move to my big, beautiful house." And she said, "But you said you'd stay in the valley till my daughter graduates from high school." He said, "I know, but I thought it over again, and I think that it's better. Isn't your promise worth anything to you? Don't you want to live with me?" And they marched in and called it off. But we went on with the reception, because if you're having a party and you've already paid for the food, it made the reception line really, really awkward. It's one of those things where you're not quite sure what to say. Congratulations, best wishes, have nice trips to wherever you're going. I found, incidentally, that I have no predictive ability in terms of marriage. They taught us to do a lot of premarital counseling, which I gave up, and I just now do postmarital, because nobody tells the truth in the premarital anyway, so might as well. Probably the two strangest weddings were, one was on Halloween weekend in Berkeley in the 60s. This is before iPhones and even cassette tapes, so I get out to the Redwood Grove, Cathedral Grove in the Redwoods, and there's a gasoline generator that's powering a reel-to-reel tape recorder that's playing in a Gata Da Vida, and if you know what I mean. And there were herbs and other substances being smoked at the time, if you know what I mean. And the couple came in, and she was wearing all black velvet, and he was wearing black velvet suit, and they exchanged pumpkins instead of rings. "You take this pumpkin as a symbol of your love and commitment to this man and this marriage. If there be any among you who can show cause why this exchange of pumpkins should not take place, let him speak now or forever hold his own pumpkin." As far as I know, they're still married. So, you know, go no. It is one of the things that life teaches you is, if you're paying attention, is humility. it's what other stories can I tell you here that are actually tellable, and not the shotgun wedding. I actually wasn't sitting in my office. I was painting my office. Don't try this again. Not with me, not with the next one, or with the next one. We're bad at this. So I'm painting my office in Hayward, California, and the phone rings. The guy says, do you do weddings? I said, yeah. Can you do one today? Well, I'm 50 miles from home. This has been the story of my life, having congregations 50 miles away. And I'm covered with paint. He says, it's not important. This marriage has to take place this afternoon. I said, oh, okay. So I'm in paint and jeans, and three people walk into my office, and one of them's carrying a shotgun. And I have all kinds of things flashing through my head, like, boy, this was a short career. I'm picturing the headline, headlines, dynamic young clergyman found. Anyway, said, he's been engaged to my sister long enough. It's time they got married. I pretended to a confidence that I was not feeling, which is also the story of how clergymen have to be, pretending to confidence that we may not necessarily feel, and said, ha, 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 go wait in the car. I'll talk to the couple. So I said, okay. Number one, if I do this, you're annullable because it's certainly under duress. And secondly, you want to be married to her? And he said, oh, yeah, we have the license. I went, good enough. They got the license. I did the ceremony. As far as I know, they're still married, but they have an injunction against the brother-in-law. It's true. Two biggest flops of sermons. If you're going to do 40 sermons a year for 45 years, they're not all going to be great. Some of them are going to be... And somebody asked me before a sermon, is it going to be good? I haven't a clue. I mean, even in the old days when I used to write manuscript and read them, it reads well, but it could be an anthropology lesson at a major university. And you don't know what the chemistry is going to be, what the room's going to be, what to react to. So I had a near-death experience up in San Francisco while I was serving Studio City. I don't know if Danzig was around for this one, but I got something that's called hemophilus attack. My throat swelled closed. I came within moments, really, of dying. And they intubated me, threw me on a gurney, and intubated me, throwing a breathing tube in onto a respirator without any anesthesia. All they did was they hit me with a curare, which they didn't tell me what that did, but all of a sudden I'm there, I can't move, I can't breathe, and my mind goes, anaphylaxis, which is right next to anatefka, but a little different. So my mind goes, anaphylaxis, you're gone. I see my body on the table. I'm thinking, you could lose weight. And then I'm thinking, because I'm still joking, even though I think I'm dead, death does not necessarily stop comedy, by the way. I'm looking down, you could lose weight, and so, you will. You will. Not a problem. This is a diet you can succeed at that doesn't take willpower. And so then they brought me back, and I healed, and I went back to the Studio City Church, and I gave this deep and important and insightful and vulnerable talk about my near-death experience and the miracle of life and what I had learned and all the epiphanies, and I'm watching, it could have been a painted canvas because I was getting nothing. Because, it goes back to something I've said fairly often, the deepest and most profound experiences we have as human beings, we really can't put into words to communicate to people who haven't had the experience. So people who had near-death experiences, who had at that time what was relatively rare open-heart surgery, they came up to me and said, wow, I was there. I got it. but I couldn't transmit it to anyone who hadn't been there, which is also an important lesson. My other flop story, and I know Jim was here for it because he was part of it, not the cause, but he remarked it's probably his favorite sermon, and I don't remember what it was supposed to be. All I remember is I was up here and I was talking to paintings. I was getting nowhere. Now, understand, it is never your fault. If you're bored, if you're detached, it's not your fault. It's my responsibility to keep you awake, alive, interested, and engaged. And if I'm not doing that, I'm failing at it. The audience is never to blame. I did too many years in nightclubs watching comedians blame audiences for not laughing. You know, it's not the audience's fault or responsibility. They came there to laugh. So I don't know what the topic was, but I'm bombing. And I kept trying to find ways of talking about something that would finally get a nod. I'm watching you. You know that I watch you. You know I'm watching you watch your watch. I'm watching your eyes. I'm watching your body motions, everything. So because it's a feedback system. That's why I don't read. It's a feedback. I need to be alive to what's going on in the room. And if you're not alive to what's going on in the room, I've got a problem. So I kept just tap dancing until I found a subject. And do you remember what the subject was? I ended up talking about the film Groundhog's Day. Now, if somebody had said, John, I'd like you to preach a sermon on the film Groundhog's Day, I would have said, are you out of your mind? Turned out that it was good. It was good because we got into that feedback loop. And what the sermon turned out to be about was really something that's basically a Hindu idea, which is, if you remember Groundhog's Day, it is he lives the same day over and over again, but each time it's a little different. He's learned something in every incarnation. And so it's not the same day. It's the same day, but he's different. He's changing. He's learning. He's growing. The person that starts out as an arrogant, narcissistic moron ends up as a human being with openness and sensitivity because he's grown and he's changed in his life. I never would have found that without a lot of blank stares from some people in the room, and I never would have been able to stick with it without some people starting to nod and their eyes starting to light up. And so understand with me and with whoever follows me that this is not about teaching from here. This is about a relationship that we have with each other. Now, I guess one of the questions is, well, you got funny wedding stories. How about funeral? Little tougher. Little tougher. This is a death and dying story. One of the pieces of intimacy that clergy get is that we are with people at most delicate times of birth, of death, of marriage, of divorce, of health, of illness. And my Unitarian Universalist sister-in-law, Wendy, who was part of the Canoga Park congregation, was dying of pancreatic cancer. And her husband, Scott, a beautiful and lovely man, were gathered around the bed and holding hands, and he's stroking her hands and saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. Wherever you go, I will find you. I will find you. Again, this is not for teachable moments. This is the poetry we have of attachment and of love. And he said, you know, your son and I will miss you terribly, but you don't have to fight. You can let go. You can go. We'll be all right. You can go. And she opens up her eyes and she said, I'm trying. She knew it was a funny line and laughed. We knew it was a funny line and laughed. And we collapsed in laughter and tears on her deathbed. And that's how we ended, in an embrace and in communication and with expressions of intimacy and expressions of love. I'm going to end with a story of one of my very first memorial services, because it is relevant to how we are together. I had married Harold to his second wife, and the first wife was still a member of the congregation, and the second wife was somewhat younger, and I got a call from the bride 10 days after the wedding ceremony that he had died on his honeymoon. And I let out, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I said something completely honest, if scatological. Oh, fill in the blank. And that actually served me well, because they were happy to have something real and an expression of something that was real. But I show up to do this memorial service at Star King Church in Hayward, and the new widow is there with her family and a child from previous marriage. And remember, she was married 10 days. And the wife of 25 years is there with the semi-adult children in the other row, with an aisle between them. And being a young minister, I hadn't a clue how to handle this. Fortunately, the family was Unitarian and also belonged to a synagogue. So Rabbi Zucker, who was well advanced in age from my 25-year-old eyes, probably a decade younger than I am now, but anyway, old gray Rabbi Zucker, I go to him before and I go, "Oy vey, what do I do?" And he said, "I'll tell you what to do. You tell the truth nicely." Wow. So simple. But the best advice I ever got as a minister. Probably the best advice I ever got as a man. Probably the best advice I ever got as a human being. Our relationship to each other is tell the truth as we understand it nicely, aware of the delicacy of feelings, aware of the vulnerability of the people whom we meet, sometimes in extremis, and sometimes in extremis when we don't know that they're having problems. Someone may be having the worst day of their life, and they've put on a face to meet the faces that they meet and come in here, or come into a restaurant, or come into a store, and we have no idea, because their act is working for them or against them. They're not ready to share the vulnerability. And you get a question, you get an interaction, and you get an opportunity to witness your values, to witness your compassion, to witness your understanding, not necessarily with the prescription that is right, with the advice that is right, but with the integrity of a caring person, and respond to not the question necessarily that's being asked, how do I get Christ in my heart, but to the question that is really being asked. What do I do with my fear? What do I do with my loneliness? What do I do with a world that at times overwhelms me? And what we say to each other, we should say nicely, starting with, "Here I am," to keep you company, to be good company, not to have the answer, not to have to be smarter, not to have to be articulate, but to be there, here, for each other. And that is really the doctrine of our church, to be available to each other, but not necessarily telephonically. to be available to each other from heart to heart with real presence and with the opportunity for real intimacy. First sermon was not a sermon. This was not a monologue. The end was a sermon. It is a message, and it is stunningly simple and really hard to do. Be there, here, now, with and for each other.